sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
The experience you went through, how did that inform your approach once you got into sales? And yes, selling's really hard, but nothing like what you went through.
Yeah, I mean, it's this perspective again, just to keep coming back to it. It's like, is cold calling hard? Yes. Is being rejected on the phone 100 times a day hard? Yes. Is the specter of losing your job because you're not hitting quota difficult? Yes. Are any of those things as difficult or hard as defying a life-threatening illness? Absolutely not.
Hey friends, welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now that was Scott Leese. He's founder of Surf and Sales, co-host of the Surf and Sales Podcast with Richard Harris. He's an author, thought leader, and Scott's joining me today on Sales Enablement, episode 785, to talk about, well, a range of things. Starting with his amazing resilience in combating a debilitating illness and launching his successful sales career. We're also digging the story behind why Scott and I both hated making cold calls early in our careers and what we did to avoid them. And we'll also dive into Scott's five biggest regrets in business and what you can do to avoid similar situations in your career. All this and much, much more. But before we get to Scott, I want to let you know how the whole team of people who work to produce this podcast are incredibly grateful for all of you who support us by listening to the show, telling your friends, and sharing it on social media. And most importantly, subscribing to the show and giving us your feedback in the form of a rating and review. Now, if you haven't already connected with me on LinkedIn, please do. You can find me to search Andy Paul. I know there's more than one of me. It's LinkedIn/real Andy Paul. All right, let's jump into it with Scott. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
It's a pleasure to finally have you on the show. So, been an interesting week. Not really sure. Somehow talking about sales stuff seems kind of unimportant.
Yeah, I'm with you. I had a bunch of events scheduled for this week and ended up removing myself, and then the events canceled themselves. And it's pretty difficult to kind of try to attempt any business as usual type stuff. It's been rough.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was going to say we have some broken windows in our building. We were on the path of one of the rallies. It was mostly peaceful, as almost all of them have been. There's a couple people in the crowd that apparently wanted to make a statement. But it's been a very, very tough week. So I thought maybe we'll talk about sales indirectly. I want to start by talking about you. So tell us the story about, if you don't mind, about, you know, you've mentioned and alluded to, but never really seen much detail about all these surgeries you went through. You had a life-threatening illness of some sort. So what was that?
Yeah, at 23 years old, I got super sick. And within 2 days of being sick, I ended up in the hospital. I had severe GI distress, and it took them a while to figure it out, but ended up with ulcerative colitis, like a really severe form of ulcerative colitis.
Okay.
As well as another autoimmune disease. And it was like this switch had been flipped in my body, and it just was never going to go off. I mean, it was really kind of an overnight change. I was playing soccer in Arizona and it just was on the about to finish grad school, and I'm 6'2", and I was about 195 pounds and in really good shape at the time. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks later, I was hospitalized and weighed 140 pounds, and my organs were starting to shut down, and I couldn't, you know, move from the hospital bed to the restroom on my own. I needed, you know, help. I mean, I was in really bad shape.
Well, how long were you in the hospital?
4 years.
4 years?
4 years. I had stints during that 4 years where I might get out for a week or two, but then I would just, you know, relapse, and the meds that they had me on, you know, wouldn't work. It was just a mess. I mean, constant, you know, trying new things, different medications here, there, and everywhere. And it just, nothing worked. Nothing calmed it down. I started to get strictures and scar tissues in my intestine. My organs started, you know, being at risk of failure. I started getting, you know, chronic kidney stones like every couple of days.
Wait, every couple of days?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit. So how would you treat that? Or did it have to pass?
There's no treating it. You know, I mean, I had a couple
of ultrasounds.
Yeah. The lithotripsy procedures and whatnot. But, you know, during this illness process, I mean, I had this absolutely excruciating pain. And so I was pumped full of, you know, Dilaudid and Demerol and
right.
morphine and oxycodone and all this, you know, stuff. And then I started to get some cancerous growths on my colon, my large intestine, coupled with a severe blockage. And so the doctors came in one time and basically said, we need to, you know, have surgery like later today, or you're not going to make it. And, you know, they tried to perform, I forget the name of the surgery now, but some type of surgery where they remove part of the large intestine and then sew it back up. And so they did that surgery, and then it sprung a leak. I don't know how else to phrase it. And so I started going sepsis, I think is the term.
Yeah, septic, right.
No, that was like my first emergency life-saving surgery, was to solve for that. So anyways, I've had about 9 surgeries. I think it's 9 on the button. 4 major abdominal surgeries, sort of filleted open from, you know, above my belly button to right above my crotch, and 2 life-saving surgeries, and a total colectomy. So I have no large intestine. I have a surgery, what's called J-pouch surgery, where they stretch the small intestine down, and that's how I function. So I'm hardwired a lot different than other people. But, you know, for me and all the things that I've been through, this is, you know, as healthy as I'm gonna get. And it is what it is. And once I started getting healthy enough to get released from the hospital, then I had a whole new challenge, which was getting off of drugs.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. But
yeah, so, you know, I got pretty fortunate. I didn't have a real severe mental side to the addiction. I was just very physically addicted to all the opioids.
I can imagine.
So, you know, I actually decided to cold turkey against doctor's orders. They were pretty upset with me. But I was just at a place where I was like, I don't want to take a fucking Advil again, let alone any kind of pills or medication. So
were you at home with your family? Were you living by yourself? Or
I was at home. I was fortunate through this whole illness that, you know, my family was able to pay my bills and support me and whatnot. So I went home from the hospital, and I was staying with my dad, and, you know, my parents, I joke with my parents, like, they're so far removed from, you know, alcohol or drug culture. I tease them sometimes, like, were you even around during the '60s? I don't even know how this happened. So they had no idea what was in store, but, you know, I knew what was in store. I've had plenty of friends who've struggled with substance abuse and whatnot. But, you know, my mindset was like, look, this is going to be horrible for like 2 to 3 weeks. And then, you know, things will get better. And after you've been through something for years, like I had, you know, 2 to 3 weeks sounded like a cakewalk by comparison.
And was it?
I wouldn't call it a cakewalk. some of the things you read and the stories you hear are you know, pretty true. I mean, I can remember lying in bed and feeling like I was levitating and swinging around and engulfed in flames. And yeah, it was just pure hallucination and, you know, a lot of pain and nausea and all that kind of stuff that comes with the territory. But, you know, it was a means to an end, for me. So it was a hell of an ordeal. It's not like I don't struggle now with, my health or anything like that. But,
what was the turning point? So what happened to sort of say, okay, I'm getting better. Was it the surgeries? Was it a new medication or?
No, it was the surgeries, you know, the large intestine was the problem and they removed the large intestine. And so things have been able to be relatively under control. You know, I have periods of time that are more difficult. I have to watch what I eat. I've got 41 food allergies that can wreak havoc on me if I'm not careful.
41 foods. So what are the most significant things
that you have to watch out for? Stuff that you'd imagine, like gluten and dairy, right, and soy and sugar and caffeine and things like this. Peanuts. I mean, I didn't know any of this stuff, right?
Like, well, maybe I should have asked, what can you eat?
Well, the closest thing is like paleo-ish. You know, I can eat fruit, vegetable, and protein. So I try to stay away from most other things. So the upshot is like my regular diet is pretty damn healthy.
Yeah, I was going to say, none of the vices.
Yeah, no, I'm just not allowed. I'll suffer the consequences. So it's certainly not worth it.
Wow. What an ordeal. I mean, I on the whole opioid thing, I remember what I felt like after being on opioids for 5 days. A couple of years ago, I was in the hospital for pancreatitis and extremely painful, and they load you up through a Dilaudid and so on. And the first two nights back, it was like I couldn't sleep because the hallucinations were so intense. And I can't imagine. That's after 5 days. I can't imagine after years.
Yeah. Well, you know, perspective, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at the time, it just felt like something I had to do and didn't seem like that long of a period of time. You know, if you told me today, hey, you're going to go through some serious withdrawals for the next 3 weeks, I'd be like, oh, fuck. You know, like that sounds pretty horrible because I'm not in the same place, right?
So that whole thing clearly interrupted your career, right? Because you were right at the start of your career at that point, or would have been the start of your career. So
it would have been the start of my career. I candidly didn't really know what I was doing with my life. I mean, I was playing semi-pro soccer still in Arizona. I had gone to grad school basically because I didn't feel like getting a job and working yet. And this was like an acceptable thing to do with yourself still, is to pursue education. So I got a master's degree in learning and instructional technology. And at the time I was really interested in just how people learn and kind of how to teach people and get that learning to stick. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. You know, my dad is a college professor, so I had this college professor thing in my head. I started to get interested a little bit in the idea of corporate training. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do at all. And then this whole health crisis hit me and, you know, I kind of lost all the things that I had studied. I mean, I had an undergraduate degree in psychology. I minored in religious studies. I had this master's degree in learning theory, but it was all 4 years since I had, you know, thought about it, and I'd never put it to use. I didn't have any job experience. So I really felt like I was just completely starting from scratch. I was 27 years old. I really never had a job before in my life that didn't involve getting paid to play sports or coach sports. So for me, getting into sales was a very, very strategic decision. It was the only thing I could think of where, you know, I could make as much money as possible, depending on how hard I worked and how well I did. And I felt like I understood the competitive landscape of it all. As an athlete, you know, if you perform well, you get paid. If you don't, you get cut.
Right.
So I got that. And I've always kind of lived for that kind of pressure. So I thought, well, I have no idea how to sell. And, you know, I'm not really that outgoing of a person. But I might as well give this a try here because I got to make up for lost time. Like everybody is ahead of me basically. And, you know, I just need somebody to give me an opportunity. And when they do, I know what I've been through. I know how hard it was and nothing will ever be that hard again. So, you know, I'm going to push myself as hard as I can to get good at this thing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask is was the experience you went through, how did that inform your approach once you got into sales? And you sort of answered that yes, selling is really hard, but nothing like what you went through.
Yeah. I mean, it's this perspective again, just to keep coming back to it. It's like, is cold calling hard? Yes. Is being rejected on the phone 100 times a day hard? Yes. Is the specter of losing your job because you're not hitting quota difficult? Yes. Are any of those things as difficult or hard as, you know, defying a life-threatening illness? Absolutely not. So I lost some of the reservation and fears that I had and the inhibitions. And I was just able to tap into that. Well, what's the worst thing that could happen? Right. And resiliency was clearly something that I, you know, had in spades. And so I got used to very quickly, like not caring about rejection. I felt very blessed to even be in the office and have a job and even just be outside breathing fresh air. And so I felt like, well, I got this opportunity and I'm not going to squander it. And I can remember walking the sales floor and kind of looking around at all my colleagues who were in various states of distraction or disarray and
despair.
Yeah, right. I remember very clearly looking around the room thinking, I'm going to destroy all these people. You know, if I can figure out how to sell, like, they just seem like they're kind of going through the motions. And I have a very specific purpose here. Like, I need to get good at this. I need to get paid quick. I need to leapfrog all these people. And I need to make a name for myself. And the only way that I knew how to do that was to just outwork everybody at the time. You know, this is a long time ago, right? This is before, you know, there was all these platforms. There was no podcast to listen to. There was no LinkedIn. There was no blogs, you know, none of this stuff. So it was very difficult to get coaching and consume content. So I didn't know what else to do other than I just got to practice.
Well, I was laughing when you're talking about that because I read something you had written that resonated with me, which was that you worked so hard to get promoted quickly because you hated cold calling so much. Yeah. And I was thinking, that's exactly what was going through my mind. My first year, I got promoted really quickly at first job because I was working so hard because I hated it as well.
Yeah. I mean, the very first day that I went to work at this sales job.
And you were selling what?
We were selling online lead generation tools to real estate agents and automotive dealers. So okay. This is like 2004, I think it is. So I go in on the first day and I'm nervous as hell. It's like very old school. It's startup, but like old school. Like I had to wear a suit and tie and all this. So I'm nervous. So we spend the morning kind of learning about the product and the industry and this kind of thing. And we come back from lunch and they're like, okay, it's time to get on the phone and make calls. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Like what? No CRM, no, you know, enablement tools, no leads. I had to source my own leads. I didn't even have a damn headset. Right. And so I can remember.
I'm not crying for you, by the way, because I can tell my story about doing that 25 years earlier. So yeah.
But I called my wife on the way home and I'm like, I'm never going back to this job. Like I'm horrible. The phone weighs 1,000 pounds. I'm terrified. I got no training, you know, and she kind of punched me in the gut and was like, well, if you don't do this, what are you going to do? And that was like a real, you know, it was a real punch to the gut. Like, you know, she's right. I have no other plans, no backup plan. But that was it. Like something about that just kicked it into high gear for me and got rid of my excuse factory and fear. But, you know, it took me in my second month full-time in the role, I became the number one rep in the company. And like you just said, I realized really fast that I hated cold calling, hated it. And I'm like, I got to get out of this role. So what's the fastest way out of this role? Well, I got to get so good at it that I can just teach other people how to do it. That was my mindset and became my mission. Yeah.
My first 12 to 18 months on the job, just sell as much as I can, get promoted. So do you remember your first order?
Oh, absolutely. 9:30 at night, one call closed, a real estate agent in Hawaii.
Nice.
I was calling Hawaii. So I was working in Walnut Creek, California. Mm-hmm. I think Hawaii at the time was 2 or 3 hours behind California. So, you know, it was like 6-7 o'clock Hawaii time, which is still pretty late. But I was cold calling Hawaii to take advantage of the time zone and, you know, got somebody that was interested and closed the deal. And I just remember being so happy. Like it was like a rush of adrenaline. The competitive juices like kicked in and I'm like, I need this feeling again. Right. And I recognized that I didn't close that deal because of skill. I recognized that I closed that deal because I was in the office 3-4 hours after closing on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And so I just kept applying that kind of effort and pressure. You know, I'd show up at 6, I'd leave at 6. I got a couple buddies who surf with me who were also working with me there, to show up at like 9:30, 10 o'clock every Saturday. And we, you know, make calls and send emails for a few hours to put in extra time. And that was how I learned, you know, it's just all trial by fire.
Yeah, no, my first order came because I decided to make one extra call at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon in person. Yes, I was actually in the East Bay of the Bay Area. My first job, territories from Fremont to Fairfield, all the way out to Rio Vista. And so, Walnut Creek, I spent a lot of time there. But yeah, selling desktop adding machines. So sort of our training program first. We had to sell some desktop adding machines in order to be trained to sell computers. And yeah, I remember going into this welding shop. I remember it's called Bucks Welding in Fremont, California. And I just decided, you know, I was walking this business park, going door to door, decided I'd make one extra call. Walking to this place, it's like soot everywhere. And I thought, there's no way they want this calculator. They, you know, buy it for bookkeeping purposes and so on. And Buck comes out and it looks like these pictures of coal miners, you know, from the 20s and 30s, you know, just the whites of his eyes show, everything covered in grime, head to foot. His clothes, and he just sat there. For some reason, was interested in buying the product. I think it was a pity sale. I was in my 3-piece dark suit with red power tie, white shirt, all that stuff. And I was nervous as hell. But yeah, just wrote me a check on the spot and took my demo unit.
Hey, you know, the pity sale for your first sale is nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah. Well, he was bemused watching me because, you know, man, you're doing manual work, but he didn't run a small business. It looked like they'd been there forever. I don't know what it was, but I took it. But yeah, you got to have that first one. Never forget Buck.
Yeah. Yeah, I never forget mine. I end up telling that story quite a bit, and it's a good one.
So tell us about your most memorable order that you've taken.
It's certainly not a deal that I close on my own, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Good ones rarely are.
I was actually only an account executive for about 6-7 months before I moved into sales manager role and been in sales leadership roles, you know, ever since. I can remember, you know, staying in the office until roughly midnight with certain teams as we were trying to do an end of the month, end of quarter blitz to either hit the team number or help them hit their personal number. And this is when I was like in my late 20s now, probably. And some of those times were a blast, honestly. Kind of miss some of those ridiculous long hour days where the team is like ordered pizza and everybody's trying to help everybody push across the line to hit some goal. I just did a deal not too long ago with a team that I was working with where it was damn near a 2-year sales cycle, and it was with the state government, and it was a low 7-figure deal. That's a very, very memorable sale for me, just because of the, not just the size of it, but the number of organizational complexities that existed trying to sell to a state government agency. I mean, you talk about building upon, you know, contacts and turning contacts into influencers and influencers into champions and champions into, you know, get you in the door with the decision maker. Right. I mean, we must have found, you know, 24 decision makers who felt like they had the ultimate authority to sign the contract or not. I mean, just a mess of a deal. Probably involved about 12 or more people internally, you know, from sales engineering resources to product engineering resources to account management, customer service, to strategic sales reps of mine, the CEO helping. I mean, that's a very memorable deal just because of how long it took and the size of it and the complexity of it.
Well, in the process, when did the moment strike you that you knew you were going to win?
Not until it was done, Andy.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
Not until it was done. I mean, my family is originally from Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York, Western New York. So I still have this mentality where, like, I'm not allowed to have nice things and the sky might be falling at any moment. So, I can't remove that.
And your parents aren't even the child of the Depression.
No. I there was signals, you know, signal after signal, this is getting serious and whatnot. But, man, not until the deal was done and everything was signed were we like, holy crap, that just happened.
What'd you do to celebrate?
Am I allowed to say on this show?
Well, say it. We can always edit it. It's not live.
Let's just say we opened a bottle of tequila a little bit early that day.
All right. That works.
And it was well worth it. Well worth it.
As long as you Ubered home, that's fine.
That's right.
So what's your, you know, you got promoted pretty quickly to sales management. You've been in sales management for a long time. You've been a VP of sales. Tell us about sort of the biggest risk you took as a manager and how it turned out.
You know, I think first of all, I've taken a lot of risks. Every single time I've been an operator, I've gone to a brand new tech startup. Mm-hmm. I mean, brand new in the sense that there's next to zero revenue whatsoever and almost no customers.
Yeah,
so every time I left one job, you know, it's a bit of a risk. You know, you go from having, you know, good base salary, good making good commissions and building something that, you know, is growing, and then this new opportunity shows up and it's like going all the way back to the start with no guarantees for anything, being successful. So that, I'm a big believer in kind of betting on myself. Mm-hmm. And taking those risks. But the answer to your question is pretty easy, actually. 2011, we decided to leave San Francisco Bay Area and move to Austin, Texas. I had just started working for a company called Main Street Hub. And the founders and I were kind of chatting through sales strategy. And I was just sort of saying, you know, I don't know that it makes sense to build a sales org in San Francisco anymore. It's so damn expensive. You know, there's these other cities out there that at the time they were, you know, really kind of up and coming small tech scenes. So we were like Austin, Atlanta, Boulder and Denver, Salt Lake City, Scottsdale. So we looked at all of these places and, you know, when we were in Austin, we just really enjoyed it and it felt like this is what we should do. So we relocated the whole company, about 10 of us. From San Francisco to Austin. I didn't know anybody in Austin, Texas at all. My wife and I went to high school together. Both of our parents live in our hometown of Chico, California still. All of our friends and siblings live in San Francisco in Northern California. So we left everything. I didn't know Austin was a fairly liberal city. I didn't know there was a college here. I didn't know there was a music. I was completely ignorant to
Cook'em horns.
Yeah. I didn't even know that saying at all.
Yeah.
So that was the risk, the biggest risk. You know, we sort of said, well, let's give it a try. And, you know, if we, if it goes south, we'll just come home. But that was a big risk and probably the biggest one I think that I've taken to leave everybody, you know, behind. But it was also, I think, the best decision I've ever made in my career and for my family. So we've been really happy here.
Yeah, I mean, Austin's a cool place. I mean, it's obviously you tell us, and it seems last time I was there a year ago, just growing leaps and bounds. I mean, it's becoming a big city very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I would call it probably the third best tech scene in the country right now, but it's certainly I think it's in the top five, if not number three. So it's grown a ton. It's kind of well known now, but you know, one of the reasons it was attractive to me in 2011 was because it was still kind of small. And, mm-hmm. and I looked at it and thought, well, I could make an impact here. You know, if I scale a couple companies here, you know, I might be able to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. Whereas if I do the same thing in San Francisco, like nobody's ever going to hear of me or know who I am. And so that was kind of attractive, you know, to me to feel like I might play some small part in building a scene out.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'd done that here and I'm pretty proud of that actually.
Yeah. I felt similar things when I left the Bay Area to move to San Diego back in basically 1990. I mean, there was mm-hmm. nothing in San Diego except for this young company called Qualcomm, and a bunch of other young companies. And yeah, my thought was I got recruited to this company and it's like, you know, there's so little going on here that if it doesn't work out, I'm going to have to move back to the Bay Area. And because there was nothing, there was no other alternatives. But fortunately, yeah, the scene grew up. So yeah. never did return. So, but you're a long ways from surfing now.
I am, but I'm a 3-hour flight to Costa Rica and a 2.5-hour flight to Nicaragua. So prior to all this chaos, you know, I've managed to get down to those two countries or to Mexico, you know, at least a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can catch more waves in a week in Costa Rica than I would all year in San Francisco, probably. So,
and a lot warmer. You're not wearing your wetsuit.
Scratches the itch. No. And, you know, I created a whole business out of my love for surfing and my love for sales. You know, Richard Harris and I created the Surf and Sales Summit, which is a micro sales conference. We take about 15 to 20 people a couple times a year to, like I said, Costa Rica. And we were going to go to Mexico and Nicaragua in September and October of this year, which might not happen now, probably won't happen now. But yeah, we work through sales workshops and sales management, leadership workshops and stuff like that. And it's kind of more about the experience and deeper networking and get a little bit of a vacation out of it. So, you know, I found a way to combine my passions and get paid to go on a surf trip. There's nothing wrong with that, you know.
There is nothing wrong with that. I need to figure that recipe out. Somehow combine sales and a trip to see a soccer game or something. So, or bike riding actually is the things that we've looked at in the past.
You'd be surprised how many people have reached out to me, Andy, and inserted activity and sales. It's like golf and sales, snow and sales, soccer and sales. And I've had people from all over the world reach out to me and say, hey, you should do one here with this sport or this activity. And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, maybe I'll license it out to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, years ago in San Diego, there was a guy that was doing golf and sales.
And there so
it was
you go.
It was less instructional, more networking, but I mean, it was sort of in the title and yeah, they serve. It died out some time ago, but yeah, it went on for several years. So no, it's great. It's a great way to do it. Thank you. I think in the small groups, great way for people to network.
And I think even more so now, you know, with everything that's gone on, you know, micro is the way to go. I think the big macro stuff might take a really, really long time to come back. I mean, I don't know what you think, but it feels to me that people will be very slow to go back to a conference with a couple hundred thousand people, but might be a little more interested in a a smaller, more intimate setting with you know, a couple dozen people where they can still learn and network and work on their skills and kind of decompress a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's a great combination of things you do. I've enjoyed following that, what you're doing, because A, it's small. B is, you know, the intimacy. We put on events with a partner. I put on an event with a partner a couple years ago for CROs of SaaS companies. It's 2.5 days. We rented a house in the Bay Area, you know, created this experience out of it. But the thing that was most notable, the takeaway, was just how the attendees bonded with each other.
Yep.
And seeing them quickly engage and share their experiences. And we were, you know, thinking after the fact, oh gosh, we probably, even though we were nominally presenting topics, we probably spoke maybe 40% of the time. And the rest was all the participants.
Yep.
So I'm with you. I think it's a great model. Well, tell people how they can find out more about it.
Oh, you can visit surfinsales.com, sign up for the sort of alerts, if you will, about when our next events are. We also ended up spinning out our own podcast to kind of get the word out there a little bit. And that's been a lot of fun. And we thank you for coming on the show a couple months
ago. Oh, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun. You guys did a great job.
Yeah.
Well, Scott, we sort of run out of time, but appreciate you taking the time to join us and share some information about yourself.
Yeah, no worries, Andy. Thanks for having me, man.
It was a lot of fun. We'll do it again.
Sounds good.
And if people want to connect with you other than Surfing Sales, any other way?
Yeah, you reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm very active there. I also recently started my own Patreon community, so you can find me on Patreon as well.
Got it.
And I'm pretty obsessive about responding to people, so if anybody reaches out to me, I'll be sure to get back to them.
All right. Scott, thank you very much.
All right. Cheers, Andy.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm so grateful for your support of this show. Also want to thank Scott Lees for sharing his insights with us today. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this podcast. If you could also leave us a rating and a review, let us know how we're doing, we'd really appreciate it. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this podcast is over, so thanks for your help. And remember, connect with me on LinkedIn. Hope you enjoyed our conversation today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.